Hi, I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening to Only a Game. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/game to give. Then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with hashtag WhyPublicRadio. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. For almost 25 years, that's what we've called the show, Only a Game. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes a game can transcend not only itself, but the context of the sport. It doesn't happen as often as the sponsors, the advertisers, the television flacks, and the agents say that it does, but it happens. And when it does, attention should be paid and the moment should be remembered.
Those brave folks who sat out here in the Orange Bowl and put up with this terrible weather, saw a whale of a football game, and they should give both teams a rousing ovation when this one is over.
On November 23, 1984, the University of Miami and Boston College staged a football game that probably still inspires in defensive coaches screaming nightmares. The two quarterbacks in that game, Doug Flutie of Boston College and Bernie Kosar of Miami, combined to throw for 919 yards, more than half a mile. They also combined for a total of 12 feet 3 inches in height. Kosar accounted for most of that. Flutie stood 5'10 when he was on his toes. Together, they established early what would turn out to be the game's plot line. The quarterback who got his hands on the ball last would probably win it. Flutie got it last, but with 6 seconds left on the clock, time for one more play, BC, down four, was barely past the middle of the field.
I really think Flutie's got to throw this ball into the end zone.
And Flutie used the first few seconds of those six to scramble back to the BC 36. The final play was called 55 Flood Tip in the BC playbook. Wide receiver Gerard Phelan's job was to tip the ball to one of the other receivers in the end zone.
Caught by Boston College! I don't believe it! It's a touchdown!
Instead, he caught it. The final score was 47-45, and the winning number wasn't established until a click before the clock ran out. Of Flutie, Phelan said, "I didn't think he could throw the ball that far." Flutie might not have thought so either. The pass traveled 64 yards, which was only one of many reasons that it provoked rhyme in a much younger me.
It wasn't God. He can't take sides when two teams come to play. But who's to say the gods weren't present on that fateful day when Flutie spotted Phelan through the wet Miami air and as the clock ticked down to nothing, launched that final prayer?
Who's to say, indeed? Not me, and I don't even like football. But hey, I'll acknowledge that I like the ballet of the long forward pass, the receiver racing to get under it, or as close to under it as he can, but maybe not quite because he has to stretch and take it on his fingertips, or, as was the case with Gerard Phelan, in the gut as he fell into the end zone so that the catch looked less like ballet than like two magnets, one big, one very small, and falling from the sky, snapping together behind an astonished and dismayed clump of defenders. And if that image doesn't quite work for you, stay with us. Give us another chance or three. Our show today is going to celebrate the origins of that most attractive of football moments, the forward pass. Flutie's famous Hail Mary wouldn't have been legal in the early days of football. Throwing the ball down the field was expressly forbidden. The story of how that rule changed involves the 26th President of the United States and 250,000 cubic feet of concrete. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Harvard Stadium has a jumbotron, cheerleaders, and a whole section for the cooler-than-cool pep band. But other than that, it doesn't look like any other sporting venue in the world. Well, there is this one place.
The idea was to model it after the Roman Colosseum. That was what the architect submitted, and that was approved.
That's Dick Friedman. He's a former editor at Sports Illustrated and a proud Harvard alum.
For people back then, they had never seen anything like it. I mean, it was like being on the moon.
Harvard Stadium was the first permanent structure built for the game of football, and at the time, the largest steel-reinforced concrete building in the world. It's shaped like a horseshoe, with Roman arches lining the outside walls and Greek columns on the inside. When the stadium opened in November of 1903, Harvard had already won three national championships. They'd win four more by 1919. And Harvard Stadium would be packed. At times, more than 50,000 people walked into the stadium on a Saturday afternoon. More than a century later, fans still climb narrow stairs to sit on the stadium's long, curved concrete benches.
What you see is what you saw back in 1903, with a few little touches here and there. But this is the original.
But while Harvard Stadium hasn't changed much since 1903, the game of football has. Dick Friedman spent a lot of time studying it.
You look at the photos of the line of scrimmage and you see 20 guys squashed in and then a couple of guys standing in back.
On nearly every play, these two masses of men would smash into each other in a cloud of dust.
Once in a while, somebody would break through with a long run, but essentially they would be gaining a few yards at a time.
Most of the excitement and the points came from the kicking game. Touchdowns were rare.
Because the defense could bunch up right in front of the goal line and didn't have to worry about a pass going over their heads and didn't have to spread out.
So when two very good teams played against each other,
you had a lot of scoreless ties. And a lot of the more astute commentators back then said that unless there was a way to get scoring higher, that the game would die of boredom and not of violence.
Which is saying something, because on October 15th, 1905, the Washington Post reported that at least 45 football players had died since the turn of the century. The newspaper said, quote, "Picked up unconscious from beneath the mass of other players, it was generally found that the victim had been kicked in the head or stomach so as to cause internal injuries or concussion of the brain, which, sooner or later, ended life." Then there were the lesser injuries. Here's sports historian Ronald A. Smith.
Broken collarbones were very common. Broken fingers were common. It was a brutal game.
Muckrakers focused on that brutality. They wanted football banned. In response, Friedman says coaches and university administrators began looking for ways to make the game safer.
And one of the ways that they came up with, and actually made a lot of sense, was to widen the field.
The theory was, with a wider field, players couldn't just stand shoulder to shoulder on the line of scrimmage. The defense would have to spread out to cover a ball carrier who ran straight for the sideline before heading down the field. There was just one problem with this plan.
One huge, immovable problem. Quite literally, it was set in stone. You could not widen the field within Harvard Stadium.
But there was another way to force the defense to spread out, the forward pass. Smith says it wasn't an entirely new idea.
People probably have heard of John Heisman.
John Heisman was a football player and coach. The Heisman Trophy is named after him.
John Heisman had recommended the forward pass, but the person who most hated the forward pass was Walter Camp of Yale.
Walter Camp is often called the father of American football. He had almost complete control over the rules committee, and he had no interest in even considering the forward pass.
It was making the game less tough.
But Walter Camp had his chance to reform football. That came when he was summoned to the White House in October of 1905 by President and Harvard football fan Teddy Roosevelt.
He called Harvard, Yale, and Princeton down to the White House to discuss the unethical play that was going on and the brutality that was going on.
Roosevelt told the men that it was their responsibility to lead the way in making the game safer, because where they led, the lesser schools would follow.
In other words, this kind of a trickle-down Reagan philosophy.
I know this will come as a shock, but the trickle-down theory didn't work. On the train back to their respective schools, the representatives considered some rules changes, but decided instead to issue a joint statement, pledging to tame the ills of the game and urging other schools to follow. But nothing much changed. And then on October 21st, 1905, in a game against New York University, a player for Union College was struck in the head, probably by the knee of one of his teammates. By the time the official blew his whistle, players had piled up on the ball. The Union College player was at the bottom, face down and unconscious. He died hours later. Henry McCracken, the chancellor of NYU, decided he'd had enough.
Henry McCracken called a meeting of all the schools that New York University played against over the last 10 years.
McCracken hoped the attendees of this meeting would vote to ban football. Instead, they decided to reform it. Meanwhile, schools across the country were dropping the sport, saying that it was just too violent. Even at Harvard, one of the school's two governing boards called for the game to be banned, much to the dismay of Harvard's young coach, Bill Reed.
Reed heard that they might be doing this, and so he asked the Harvard Athletic Association to set up a committee to reform intercollegiate athletics. This group comes up with 19 suggestions.
One of those suggestions was the forward pass. Instead of bringing his list to the old rules committee, the one dominated by the forward pass-hating Walter Camp, Reed brought it to McCracken's group.
And Reed tells this new rules committee, he says, if we don't get these 19 rules passed, Harvard is going to vote football out.
McCracken's committee agreed to Harvard's demand to institute the forward pass, and Harvard agreed to join them in reforming the game.
And when Harvard moved over, Yale and Princeton almost had to do, and so they jointly came up with rules.
You know, I think a little bit is more is made of this split schism.
Again, Dick Friedman.
It's not the Catholic Church in the 1400s, you know, I mean, that kind of thing. Eventually, everybody had to be on board with the forward pass, and they were.
Eventually, the threat of the forward pass worked to help spread out the defense and open up the game. But under the 1906 rules, only a fool would actually try to use it.
Pass interference was legal. You know, a guy could be running out to try to catch the pass, and you could do anything to him. You could mug him.
If the receiver dropped the ball, the offense would be penalized 15 yards. If the ball fell to the ground without anyone touching it, the team would lose possession.
It took a few years for these rules to work themselves out, but none of this would have happened if Harvard Stadium could have been wider.
Are you sure?
It probably wouldn't have happened. I don't know. Eventually somebody would have said, hey, maybe we should be throwing the ball forward. You know, it could be fun.
That's writer Dick Friedman speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given. Friedman's forthcoming book is called The Coach Who Strangled a Bulldog, How Harvard's Percy Haughton Tamed Yale and Reinvented Football. Benny Friedman was very good at throwing a football.
He would throw almost as many touchdown passes as the rest of the division combined.
The story of Benny Friedman, coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Dr. Fish SG for leaving this review on Apple Podcasts. Bill and company dig deep each week with entertaining, touching, and informative stories from sport. Always a good listen about current events or ancient history. You don't need to be a hardcore sports fan to enjoy Only a Game. Don't miss out. Thanks to Dr. Fish SG, fewer people will miss out on Only a Game every week. And if you'd like to help even more listeners find our show, please do consider leaving a review at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. Big-time pro sports have been in Las Vegas for a couple of months now, and we're going to start with an update from family-friendly Sin City. My guests are Sports on Earth's Will Leach via Skype and WBUR's Shira Springer. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Will, I understand that you have been to Las Vegas recently. You still got your shirt?
Yes. Yeah, you don't so much visit Las Vegas as you do escape. But yes, I was in Las Vegas working for a story about the Vegas Golden Knights. And by the way, they're not the Las Vegas Golden Knights. They are just the Vegas Golden Knights, because that's how you convey hockey hipness, is to lose the loss, I guess. But the Vegas Golden Knights have really been kind of a revelation this year. They're an expansion team in the NHL that is having a terrific season. They're atop their division. And perhaps most fascinating, as I found when I attended their game against the Carolina Hurricanes this week, they are a huge hit locally. Now, one of the big things you've always heard about teams in Las Vegas is, well, they'll get tourist traffic, but there's no local crowd to go see them. It'll be a local curiosity, like seeing Penn and Teller. What I've noticed being at the games is there is a clear fan base. I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, I think it is the first team to get there. The Oakland Raiders are going there in a couple years. There's a WNBA team, the Las Vegas Aces, that are coming next year. But this is the first one. I think people want something theirs. And I think part of that's connected to the second idea, which is, frankly, in the wake of the shooting in Las Vegas in October, Vegas strong signs are everywhere. There's a sense of community in Las Vegas that I feel like the Golden Knights have benefited from. But all told, I was really surprised and impressed by how truly enjoyable and very community-oriented the Vegas Golden Knights were.
When they first started out, I was wondering who was attending their home opener. And from what I heard and from statistics on StubHub, more than 60% were coming from out of state. So I automatically assumed that this was a crowd of largely tourists. But I have to say, I'm really glad to hear that it is a strong local fan base, because I think that's what will lead to sustainability for this franchise.
For the record, I love Penn and Teller.
I do too. I would
go see the Vegas Golden Knights only if Penn and Teller were in fact available somewhere else the night before or the night after, so that I could see them. But I'm happy to hear this. It sounds like a much healthier situation than might otherwise have prevailed. So, Will, this is all good, right?
I have a rare inspirational story. Every time I come on, I'm always making some sort of snarky joke. But you know what? Good for the Vegas Golden Knights. Now they get to welcome in Raiders fans, and the feel-good story will totally disappear once the Raiders come to Las Vegas and those fans go insane.
Shira, I understand that you have been thinking about the country's most popular sport to some extent this week. What's on your mind?
Well, to some extent, Tom Brady launched his fitness and wellness app this week, and that really caught my attention, largely because to get that app, you have to pay $200 a year.
Wait, aren't most apps free?
Yes, but not Tom Brady's. And besides this, like, absolutely galling price point, the advice that I think he's giving out on this app isn't exactly sound wellness and fitness advice. Honestly, that's what really got me. This is a compliment on his TB12 book. You might remember the infamous advice he gave in that book, which was, if you drink a lot of water, you won't get a sunburn, or it'll help prevent sunburns. So a lot of the medical advice or fitness and wellness advice he's giving is a bit sketchy. And listen, I know there are a lot of celebrities out there. They have these lifestyle empires. But I'm really worried, particularly when you have a guy like Tom Brady who's saying, you know, sustain peak performance, be at your best into your 40s and 50s if you do what I do, that it's not only bad advice, but it could at some point become hurtful or dangerous advice. And I'm wondering if we should sort of pull back or have some warnings when it comes to sports stars giving out this kind of advice.
Alex Guerrero is his longtime trainer, and this is a guy that's been sued twice for fraud.
By the Federal Trade Commission, yeah.
Yeah, like there's legitimate issues here. There's things in here, wellness blankets, really all kinds of strange things. And the thing that I find most worrying about this is, listen, Tom Brady, like, this is the type of thing you would expect someone, a retired athlete like 25 years ago, to be selling when he's on his last legs, right? Mm-hmm. Like the car dealership is closed down and you need something to be able to sell. So to see Tom Brady doing this, Tom Brady, A, doesn't need the money. B, does not need the potential hit to his reputation that being involved with someone like Alex Guerrero is, which leads the only horrifying conclusion: Tom Brady actually believes that these things will make you better.
You know, the two of you have put me in a very peculiar position, and that is I have to stand up for an NFL player. Tom Brady is going to play until he's 50, but at some point he's going to reach 50, and his wife is only going to make that supermodel-type salary for another couple decades, no more than that, certainly. They have to plan for their retirement, just like anybody else. You have to have something you can fall back on. No, seriously.
Nice try, Bill.
It's the best I can do. What I really think about this is it's the old let the buyer beware.
Let the buyer beware until it leads to skin cancer, you know?
Oh, hey, yeah, absolutely.
Yet another place where Tom Brady and InfoWars cross over.
All right, we want to move on now, or at least I do, because my topic is the only one left. LaVar Ball, now the father of three pro basketball players. Lonzo plays for the Lakers. LiAngelo and LaMelo have signed with a pro team in Lithuania, and LaVar has said, quote, I think it's a good situation because I thought of it. The middle son, LiAngelo, was with UCLA. The youngest one is 16 years old and now has signed a pro contract. I've read some stories about the Pro Basketball League in Lithuania, and it doesn't sound good. There's a coach there who's been selling meat out of the trunk of his car after games, which sounds a little sketchy. The paychecks are sometimes late and sometimes they don't show up at all. The city where these two guys are going to play has been described as having recreational opportunities that range from very little to none. Does anybody want to argue that this is a great career move for these two guys? Shira?
Yeah, I was going to say, I will argue that it's an interesting and potentially good career move for one reason and one reason only. After the first game or so, the two younger Ball brothers might actually be able to get some time out of the spotlight and away from their father. And I think that's a pretty positive thing. LaVar Ball has said he's going to kind of go between Lonzo Ball's games with the Lakers and some time in Europe and not be there in Lithuania full time. So I think a little time out of the spotlight for those two younger brothers and a little time away and independence from their father is not altogether a bad thing.
Well, for what it's worth, if they're getting paid in meat, I think it is worthwhile to go ahead and be out there. You know, it is kind of a shame because this model of rather than playing a year in college where you are not paid and you put yourself up to injury, instead going and playing overseas, is actually not a terrible idea. But as usual, it tends to be the case with LaVar Ball, it is being executed terribly. Unfortunately, now that LaVar Ball has made this very dumb decision for his children, I think less and less people are going to take that chance.
I love your idea of players going to Europe for a year to expose and dramatize the corruption of the current rule where they're supposed to go to college and pretend to be college students. But when the kid is 16 years old, I have a problem with that. And also, my understanding is this league in Lithuania is a very physical league. This kid doesn't even have all his growth, and he may get banged around. And also, I just don't think LaVar Ball, being who he seems to be, according to the way he's been portrayed in the press, I don't think he's going to be separated from these guys.
You think LaVar Ball is moving to Lithuania, learning Lithuanian?
I think he's going to commute. I think he's going to commute. You can do that these days.
It will work out well for him until he is arrested for illegally importing meat from Lithuania into the United States.
And you're really stuck on this.
I really am. The guy sells meat out the back of his car. Why aren't you guys stuck on it?
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports on Earth's Will Leach and WBUR Shira Springer. She also contributes to the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Everybody knows Notre Dame made the forward pass famous, right? That moment was recreated in a 1940 movie, Newt Rockne, All-American. Here's Newt.
Coach, let us use the forward pass. I know it'll work.
I'm not so sure. We've never seen it in the game.
Neither has the Army. What can we lose?
The Army was the football team from the U.S. Military Academy. On the autumn day in 1913, chronicled in the film, Newt Rockne begged his coach to give the forward pass a try.
All right. It's your idea, Rock. If you think you can put it over, go ahead.
Thanks, coach.
Can you hear the tension building? The crowd portrayed in the movie could, and they were rewarded with a touchdown pass.
They can't do that.
They just did for 45 yards. It'll revolutionize football.
Well, that was certainly rousing. But it wasn't entirely accurate.
I just can't believe that people were going, oh my God, Notre Dame won by throwing the football.
Kent Stevens, the historian and curator at the College Football Hall of Fame, acknowledges that nobody builds up its own mythology like Notre Dame. His explanation for the popularity of the forward pass is more nuanced.
You know, there's gradual changes as opposed to this overnight sensation that changes everybody's opinion on everything.
Okay, gradual changes, but a case can be made that if you want to pin a medal on somebody for popularizing the forward pass, you might choose Benny Friedman. Friedman was born in Ohio in 1905, a year before the forward pass became legal. For years, it was rarely employed. According to Murray Greenberg, who has researched the life of Benny Friedman, one reason for that was the ball itself.
It looks a lot like a rugby ball, more round than the slender, oval, spheroid ball that we're used to seeing today. They couldn't grip it properly. It was almost shot putted down the field.
Well, sure it was, except when it came time for Benny Friedman to get his hand on that big round ball. Friedman's family was from Russia. He was an Orthodox Jew, and he was determined to shatter the stereotype of the Jewish man as pale non-athlete. He took up competitive bodybuilding, and he succeeded like a champ. In every photo, he looks terrific. Among the muscles he strengthened were the ones in his hands. To do that, he developed various exercises.
He would lift chairs from the bottom of a chair leg and flip them. He would spread his fingers out on the corner of a table and press as wide as he could to increase his grip size and strengthen his grip.
By the time he reached high school, Benny Friedman was throwing a football more accurately and with more confidence than passers who'd preceded him. He led his high school team to the Cleveland City Championship. When it came time to choose a college, he picked one of the places where football would eventually matter a lot.
And he really took over the Michigan football program by storm. He wasn't concerned about passing on first or second down like everybody else. He knew he could do it. He used to say, "Why wait till third down to pass? That's when everybody's expecting you to do it."
Benny Friedman awed no less an authority than Newt Rockne, who once claimed the passer could, quote, hit a dime at 40 yards. Friedman made All-American twice and was named the Big Ten's Player of the Year in 1926. Going pro in those days was an iffy proposition. Friedman joined the Cleveland Bulldogs, which in short order became the Detroit Wolverines. In 1928, as a Wolverine, he led the NFL in touchdown passes. He had 9. Nobody else had more than 5, so 9 was enough to convince the owner of another team that Friedman was worth pursuing.
Tim Mara's New York Giants were struggling big time. Nobody was coming to games, and he really needed something to stabilize his franchise. And he started thinking, you know, this guy is so sensational, and on top of that, he's Jewish. Imagine if I had this player, this Jewish player, in New York City, what that would do for my team.
The problem was that the Wolverines knew what they had in Benny Friedman. They weren't about to trade him to the Giants. So Mr. Mara did what he had to do.
The only way he could see getting him was to actually buy the entire Detroit franchise. And he did.
The tactic was extreme. The payoff was immediate.
Because people started coming to the games. They started coming to see Benny Friedman play. The red ink that the Giants had been running for several years turned to black right after Benny's first season.
Throughout that first season and into the next two with the Giants, Friedman continued to make believers of coaches and fans who'd been dubious about the forward pass. He finished his career by playing 3 seasons for the NFL team in Brooklyn and retired as a player in 1934 after being named first-team All-Pro in 4 seasons. So maybe he should have been a lock in 1963 when the Pro Football Hall of Fame inducted its first class, right? Because by 1963, everybody knew the forward pass was more fun than anything else in football, right? But quarterback Friedman was no lock.
He was not. And year after year went by, and years rolled into decades. And he just was not included in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, which was extremely important to him. You know, I think there are some athletes who really maybe don't care that much about something like that. But Friedman was very, very proud of his ability, and he really, really wanted that honor.
Ironically, that pride and the way Benny Friedman sometimes expressed it may have had something to do with his exclusion from the Hall of Fame. He told people what he'd done and how significant he felt it had been, which some regarded as unseemly. Decades later, he made enemies by blasting the players and owners who decided that men who had retired from the league before 1958 shouldn't be included in the pension plan. There has also been speculation that one of the qualities that made him so attractive to Giants owner Tim Mara, his Jewish heritage, accounted for the refusal of bigoted Hall of Fame voters to support him. Prejudice is sometimes hard to prove. As a young man, Benny Friedman had been triumphant, handsome and successful, and revolutionary in terms of football. Old age was not kind to him. He was not well in his retirement. Eventually, diabetes and a blood clot led to the amputation of a leg, and at the age of 77, he'd had enough. After leaving a note that said he refused to be the old man on the park bench, Benny Friedman shot himself in the head. That was in 1982. And then, in 2005, thanks in part to the efforts of some of the football players and others who knew him for his good work when he'd coached football and headed the athletics department at Brandeis University, Benny Friedman made it into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was inducted with fellow quarterbacks Steve Young and Dan Marino.
And so you could say it took him a long time and he never got to see it himself, but at least, you know, his bust rests in good company. I like to say that if Benny were here, given his, shall we say, confident nature, he might say Steve Young and Dan Marino's busts are in good company being next to his. But you know what? He wouldn't be entirely wrong.
You can learn more about the man who did so much to popularize the forward pass from Murray Greenberg's book, Passing Game, Benny Friedman and the Transformation of Football. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Once upon a time, there was a podcast. A podcast that told stories, especially for kids. This podcast gathered folktales from around the world and found amazing actors to bring them to life, including some you might recognize from movies and TV.
Dear wise old woman, you are a genius!
Yep, that's Jason Alexander from Seinfeld.
You won't believe this!
I'm Rebecca Shear, and this podcast we're talking about, it's a real thing. It's called Circle Round. And whether you're a kid, a grown-up, or young at heart, we're coming your way this fall from the WBUR iLab. Hear the first episode now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And come circle around on our website, wbur.org/circleround.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a smile, a wink, and a cherished holiday hockey gift. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It has been an especially bad pro football season in terms of injuries to blue-chip players, and last weekend's action sidelined another one, Eagles quarterback Carson Wentz. Does that ground the Eagles?
It put some salt on their wings or whatever it is you used to do to birds to catch them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was the key to a really good Eagles team, and they've got an experienced backup anyway. But if you're an NFL fan, this is what you live with.
Lee Dragna, who has season tickets for New Orleans Saints games, has not attended a game since week two this season, and he sued the team because he says the Saints have not provided the entertainment to which he felt he was entitled. Going into the weekend, the Saints were 9-4, tied for the lead in their division. What's this guy's gripe?
His gripe was that they knelt during the national anthem, and he decided he would not be, as his suit says, entertained or have intellectual enjoyment in the football game because of stuff they did before it. I hope the judge is in a good mood when he kicks Lee Dragna out through the window of the courthouse.
Indianapolis Colts kicker Adam Vinatieri missed two field goal attempts last Sunday. The Colts lost that game, bad enough for them, but Vinatieri may have lost a lot more than the rest of his teammates did. $500,000 more. How'd that happen?
He has to make 90% of his field goals to get a $500,000 bonus, and now he's at 88 because of the two he missed in Buffalo in the snow. And, of course, Adam Vinatieri first became an NFL star by a couple of kicks he made in the snow in the famous Tuck Rule game that led to the Patriots' first Super Bowl. So this is kind of funny, actually, that snow is going to keep $500,000. Funny for me, by the way, not for him.
Not for him. Under intense pressure for many years to change the name of the Washington, D.C. football team that he owns, this week Daniel Snyder finally did it. No, he didn't, right?
No, some wonderful internet pranksters changed the name of the team to the Washington Redhawks with a very cool logo, I might add, on the side of the
helmet. That's why everybody believed it.
And, of course, unbelievably, Dan Snyder and the Redskins had no sense of humor about this at all.
Hard to believe. Tennessee Titans quarterback Marcus Mariota lashed out at the media after last Sunday's loss to Arizona, but he apologized this week. What was up with that?
His mom told him he'd been rude to the reporters.
Oh.
And I appreciate Mother Mariota. I wish she would go around to the mothers of lots of players. But actually, what Mariota did wasn't really that bad. I mean, in cursing, he was just very curt and abrupt in his answers, and Mother Mariota was not happy with this.
Charlie, a lot of people figured correctly, as it turned out, that this week's Alabama Senate race would be close. But is it fair to say that very few people thought that Alabama football coach Nick Saban would help determine the result, which was, of course, a win for Doug Jones?
Yeah, we were all wondering how many write-in votes Nick Saban got, and apparently he got a substantial amount.
Enough.
The other sports-related item in this, of course, is Charles Barkley is now a kingmaker in the South.
Alan Trammell and Jack Morris were voted into the Baseball Hall of Fame this week. They were teammates for 14 years in Detroit. What is this, the year of the Tiger?
I feel bad about Lou Whitaker, who was at least as good as Alan Trammell,
right.
And he
and
got left out in the rain out here. Right. Darrell Evans.
And the other guy who got left out in the rain was Louis Tiant. When are they going to vote?
And
Tiant?
Marvin Miller, again.
Yeah, again.
Of course, right. I mean, these all pale next to the outrage of, once again, Warren Zevon and Little Feet not making the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week.
We spoke recently, Charlie, about Rick Pitino's suit against the University of Louisville after they fired him. This is the United States of America, so this week the university sued Rick Pitino for wrongful conduct stemming from his alleged role in a bribery scandal involving Adidas. Lawyers on both sides are going to do very well, I'm sure. But what does Louisville have to gain by suing Pitino? It's not going to make him go away any faster, is
well,
it?
Not just that. The discovery process is going to be a bloodbath
going
both ways. I think a quiet settlement is called for here.
First, Las Vegas got an NHL franchise, the Golden Knights, whom we spoke of earlier in the program. Your favorite hockey team, if I'm not mistaken. Now,
no.
The alleged entertainment capital of the world has acquired a WNBA franchise. What'll they be called?
The Las Vegas Aces, Bill.
Oh,
the
go.
Aces.
All right.
I like that.
Are they going to be the Vegas Aces, or will they keep the loss?
They're keeping the loss, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The Aces used to be the San Antonio Stars, so I guess San Antonio is just a lousy basketball town.
Yeah, it's terrible. There's no future for any kind of professional basketball there. No.
The Buffalo Bills won last Sunday, and some hours after their victory, several Bills players helped a bunch of people push their cars out of the snow in a bar parking lot. I wonder if they'd have done that if they'd lost.
I don't know, but obviously because it's 2017, there's video and photos. Apparently the Bills were just in there unwinding after beating the Colts. And, you know, a bunch of burly guys is exactly what you need to get your car out of the snow.
And finally, Charlie, athletes who test positive for performance-enhancing drugs have come up with all sorts of excuses and explanations. It was in the health food. I didn't know it was there. Are you ready to give Jeremy Curley of the New York Jets the award for most creative explanation ever?
Well, it is Christmas time, Bill, and there are legendary Christmas stories about ghosts appearing. So I think it was the ghosts of pharmacists past who tainted his sample, because Jeremy Curley said it was a ghost.
Yeah.
And I think it's the ghost of pharmacist past.
I don't. I think it was the ghost of pharmacist sneaky. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
We're now ready to move into the Texas oil fields. For the cause.
For the cause.
This is a scene from the 1941 serial western King of the Texas Rangers. It's your basic cowboys versus Nazis story. Nazis try to sabotage the oil fields. Cowboys try to stop them.
The governor and I have discussed your request to become a Texas Ranger.
Yes, sir.
The actor playing that polite young man joining the Rangers was one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, Sammy Baugh. And while Slingin' Sammy was known in the NFL as something of a cowboy, he didn't start off that way. Here's only a game's Martin Kessler.
22 years ago, sports writer Dan Daly flew to Dallas and started driving west on Highway 20 toward a part of Texas called the Big Empty. He was searching for 81-year-old Sammy Baugh. It had been decades since Baugh retired from the NFL as the all-time leader in passing yards and touchdowns, and he hadn't been seen outside of Texas in years.
I've got my directions scribbled down on a sheet of paper, and I'm praying to God they're right. Because some of them just sound really, really bizarre, you know, like take a left at State Route 580, and I'm thinking, what if there's no sign? What if I just drive forever and end up in Nebraska or something?
Eventually, Daly turned down a dirt driveway. All around him, it was flat as far as the eye could see. The driveway led to a little white house.
I was surprised how small a place it was. And I knocked on the door. No one came to the door. So I go around to the other side of the house to see if there's a window I could look in to see if there's anybody there. And I see this glow behind the drapes. It's clear that somebody's watching television. So I knock on the window, and the drapes spread, and there's this big guy.
It was Sammy Baugh. He came to the door. And for the next 5 hours, the two men talked.
Can I turn this down just a bit? That'd be okay? Just so I can tape what you say and not lose anything?
This is from Daly's recording of that 1995 conversation.
Is that okay?
God, punch your own button.
There we go, great.
Until Daly shared his mini cassettes with me last week, no one else had ever heard the recording. For most of the 5 hours, Baugh laughs and tells stories about his time in the NFL, occasionally pausing to comment on the college football game on the TV, and more than occasionally pausing to spit.
He had this gigantic plastic cup with a handle on it, the kind that you get if you're buying like a double gulp. And he used it as a spittoon because he was a tobacco chewer. And every minute or so, he'd lean over and grab the handle and spit into the cup.
And then there was Baugh's language.
Oh, he was mean. You wouldn't think that son was mean, but he was mean.
He didn't have that social filter that many of us have. It tells you that he probably wasn't used to being interviewed all that much.
Sammy Baugh, the greatest quarterback of his generation, the guy who helped make the NFL the forward pass-obsessed league that it is today, had become a reclusive cowboy. This is how that happened. Baugh grew up in a small Texas town. He was far more interested in playing sports than riding horses. He didn't have anything to do with ranching. Baugh was a decent high school football player, but his number one sport was baseball. He played third base and had a great arm. In 1933, Baugh joined the baseball and football teams at Texas Christian University. He expected to play third base and punt for the football team. He'd always been good at that. Most college teams from the East and Midwest were still avoiding the forward pass, but Dutch Meyer, the football and baseball coach at TCU, loved it.
Hell, we could throw the ball anytime we wanted to. And Dutch told us, if you've got a reason for doing it, I'll never second guess you.
Soon Meyer figured out that his third baseman with the strong arm would actually make a darn good passer. During his junior and senior seasons, Baugh led the country in both punting and passing. And that caught the attention of the owner of the NFL franchise in Washington, D.C. George Preston Marshall had a plan for the skinny kid from Texas who the fans and writers were already calling Slingin' Sammy. Washington drafted Baugh 6th overall, and before Baugh boarded the plane for D.C., Marshall instructed him to wear a cowboy hat and boots.
Marshall was such a showman, and he wanted to create this image of the Texan and the cowboy in the minds of the Washington market.
That's Dan Daly again. Baugh wasn't used to wearing cowboy boots. He said they hurt his feet, but he recovered in time to play game one.
Sammy was a sensation. No one had ever seen anybody throw the ball as accurate as Lee threw it.
That year, Baugh led the NFL with 1,127 passing yards and 8 touchdowns. Washington won the championship. Soon, Baugh was being asked to fly off to Hollywood. Baugh starred in that Cowboys versus Nazis serial, but he kept a low profile in L.A. According to Joe Hawley's biography, Slingin' Sam, Baugh ate lunch on set with the technicians. They had the best stories. At night, he stayed in. Baugh told a magazine writer, "It didn't make sense to be showboating all over Hollywood and spending a lot of money for a steak when I could take that money back to Texas and buy a whole cow." And that's what he did. In fact, he bought an entire ranch 250 miles west of Dallas. He was starting to become a real cowboy. Once World War II began, Baugh's ranch provided beef for the war effort. That meant he wasn't drafted. He kept playing, and during the 1943 season against lower-grade competition, he led the NFL in passing, punting, and interceptions. Baugh played safety, too. In 44, the draft board told Baugh he had to work at his ranch full-time. That was okay with him. He liked the ranch. But he asked if he could still fly to games on weekends. He says the draft board told him,
"You want to go somewhere on weekend? Go." I said, "Well, I'll be back Monday morning." He said, "Hell, we don't care. I said, you get back Monday."
Sammy Baugh retired in 1952, after 16 seasons in Washington. Joe Hawley wrote of Baugh, "What Babe Ruth's home runs did for Major League Baseball, Sam Baugh's passing did for the National Football League." After retiring, Baugh coached for about a decade, but a funny thing happened. The guy who'd once complained about the cowboy boots hurting his feet realized he liked ranching better than football. He started spending all his time raising cattle and roping. In 1963, he was one of two unanimous selections for the Pro Football Hall of Fame's inaugural class. He'd often get asked to attend events at the Hall of Fame or in Washington, but he'd decline. He told Dan Daly he hated wearing suits.
"And it just irks hell out of me to have to go anywhere where I have to put a tie and suit on."
And after all those trips from Texas to D.C., he especially hated flying. So if anyone wanted to see Sammy Baugh, the quarterback who'd changed football, they'd have to go to him. And that's why Dan Daly set out on that journey to the Big Empty 22 years ago to hear Sammy Baugh tell stories.
"Can you tell me much of anything about Ernie Pinkert?"
"Ernie Pinkert, goddamn, you've got a good one there. Ernie Pinkert."
Eventually, Daly realized it was time to go. Not just because 5 hours had passed, but because Baugh had filled his plastic cup with tobacco spit. So Daly started the 250-mile drive back to Dallas. In 2008, Sammy Baugh died at the age of 94. Baugh's ranch is still in operation. His son David is in charge now. I called him up the other day. Could you describe what it looks like out your window right now?
"Well, the wind's blowing, and it's about 35 degrees. It's kind of cold. We've been feeding cattle, and sun is shining brightly, and it's a pretty morning."
David said his father didn't talk much about his role in developing the forward pass. He was prouder of his ranch.
"Oh, he was a real cowboy. On his tombstone, it says a pretty good cowman, and that's how he wanted to be remembered."
That's David Baugh speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Our huge thanks to Dan Daly for sharing his interview with Sammy Baugh. You can link to some of Dan's articles at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with the help of Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. In our final word this week, Sammy Baugh explains why, whenever one of his receivers dropped a pass, he'd tell the media he must have thrown it too hard.
"He feels worse about dropping it than I do, really, if you know what I mean."
I've got to learn that attitude for when one of the producers here makes a mistake. I mean, in case one of them ever does. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.